Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and the opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centraliljwj.org. That's centraliljwj.org. And Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. And we have James Kilgore in the studio with us, who we're going to be talking with him here shortly. First of all, we have a few news stories here, and I guess I'll go first, Bob, if that's okay. Taxpayers could be on the hook for trillions of dollars in oil derivatives. Senator Elizabeth Warren charged Citigroup last week with holding government funding hostage to ran through its government bailout provision. At issue was a section in the omnibus budget bill repealing the Lincoln Amendment to the Dodd-Frank Act, which protected the depositor funds by requiring the largest bank to push out a portion of the derivatives business into non-federal FDIC-insured subsidiaries. Elizabeth Warren and Representative Maxine Waters came close to killing the spending bill because of this provision, but the tide turned, according to Waters, when not only Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, but President Obama himself lobbied lawmakers to vote for the bill.
Disappointing, yes.
Well, not unexpected, though. But anyway, it's really interesting how, you know, this fall in gas prices recently is there's a lot of correlations to what's going on here with this bailout. Banks basically have lent a lot of money to a lot of these shale oil extractors, and plus it turns out that at first they was called conspiracy theory by some, but then it was later verified it was a fact that actually the U.S. State Department has made an agreement with the Saudis to keep oil prices low, in other words production at the current levels, to basically as a weapon, an economic weapon against Russia.
After the financial crisis of 2008, the Dodd-Frank bill was instituted, and one of the things that did was put more regulations on these derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
And we just turned right around and undid the regulations that got us into this big financial mess. So we don't seem to learn too much from our past mistakes.
Well, that could be a topic of at least half a program, because there's a big difference between us and them, you know, the 99%
well, yes,
versus the 1%.
Yes, and my shirt says.
Yes, indeed. And, what's interesting is that, they're talking about how this is really going to hurt like a lot, you know, a lot of these, a lot of municipalities and even states invested a lot of money, investments into these various derivatives, and it's really going to hurt them. And but what's interesting, this article I've got, they got a real interesting solution here towards the end of the article. One, of course, is to restore the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the act that was repealed that made this 2008 financial crisis happen. Right. This was passed back in the 1930s under Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a way of controlling the banks. Basically, it separates commercial banking from investment banking.
After the collapse of the stock market in 1929,
correct.
We put that in there.
The other alternative.
And I believe Jamie Dimon was instrumental in repealing the Glass-Steagall Act as well.
Robert Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary under Clinton, and then the Republicans, of course, jumped, you know, we're all for it as well. But another solution this person who wrote this article stated was that another alternative for protecting our funds from Wall Street gambling can be done at the local level. But our state and local governments can establish publicly owned banks, and our money, both public and private, could be moved into them. And currently, from my recollection, South Dakota has a state bank still, of all places. And from what I understand, when they initiated that state bank in North Dakota, back in the 1890s, it was fought tooth and nail by the banks at that time, and it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
You know, what's really funny is states like the Dakotas, Wyoming, which was very early, giving women the right to vote. Montana still has this really hardcore campaign finance law that the Supreme Court doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And, North Dakota or South?
It's North Dakota,
South, of course. North Dakota has had this bank, and it all goes back to progressive era, and it's just like, the what's the matter with Kansas thing?
Mm-hmm.
And now there's some of the most hardcore conservative, and I'll also go out and say it, just racist states,
mm-hmm.
you know, imaginable.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, in that book, What's the Matter with Kansas by, what's his name? Frank?
Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank. Not to be confused with the, general that destroyed Iraq.
Okay. Yeah. And his point in that book was the reason those, states like Kansas, why they turned, like that was because the Democratic Party in general abandoned the working class and they basically quit voting for him. And the fundamentalist Christians, and other right-wing interests just kind of filled the vacuum, if you will.
Okay. I want to get in a plug for Thomas Frank. He has put out, I started reading it should be a quarterly, but it's not,
mm-hmm.
Journal that he was putting out, I think maybe back in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
and it's called The Baffler,
mm-hmm.
and there was one out at Barnes & Noble's last week.
Okay.
But, if you can come across that, The Baffler is usually very good, some of the best writing you'll ever find.
Okay. And Bob, do you have any news stories?
Yeah. Okay. Or credit unions, Dave.
Oh, credit unions, of course. Yes, yes. That would be definitely the local solution.
Right. A third of Walmart stores in the U.S. must raise their base wages coming up in 2015 here.
Oh, I bet they hate that.
Yes. This is Walmart, the largest private employer in the U.S., will be forced to raise its wages thanks to the new minimum wage hikes in 21 states that take effect during the new year. Reuters reports that the retail giant is preparing to raise its base salary in about a third of its stores in the U.S. Currently, it says here about 6,000 Walmart employees make that minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. According to what Reuters is reporting, Walmart's going to have to change its pay structure in 1,434 stores to narrow the gap between low-paid workers and higher-skilled positions. Company has also pledged to make more changes in 2015 to give workers more opportunity for advancement. As it says here, Walmart workers have been striking for years against the company's notoriously poor treatment of employees. On Black Friday this year, thousands protested at 1,000 stores across the country, calling for a livable wage and more reliable working orders. Walmart keeps many employees on an erratic part-time or temporary schedules to avoid giving them full-time benefits. As the story kind of mentions here, the way they're going to address this is they're going to raise the minimum wage for some of these people, and they're going to actually lower the wages that they pay to some of the people that get paid a little bit more. So typical Walmart fashion.
Divide and conquer, too.
Yeah, they're going to find a way.
Close the gap. Like
they're going to narrow the gap between the lowest people that they pay and some medium people.
Yeah.
So it's those people's fault they're going out and striking.
Right, right. So typical Walmart there for you.
Oh man. You know, one thing I forgot to mention on this story too that I wanted to add is, besides this coming bailout, another bailout that looks like it's coming down the tubes is that we want to, right, beginning the first of the year, there's going to be a huge public relations, campaign to try to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Obama and the Republicans and the corporate Democrats are all behind this. And, you know, it's been beaten back here in the last couple years. This is a real threat to not only our further eroding our standard of living, but to our actual democracy. And we need to be aware of this and make sure we've got fight back in place.
Oh, you know, Dave, something that you just mentioned, the word democracy, and something that I've been coming across last few years, and I don't know where this started, is probably some Republican thing, you know, but it's the idea you get talking to some conservative right-wing person, and they'll start saying, oh, but this isn't a democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not a democracy, you know, and we're a republic.
Yeah.
And what I tell them is I say, well, yeah, we're a republic. We use democratic process. But what I think people ought to start saying is, okay, how do you want things to be decided? Do you want a theocracy? Do you want a totalitarian government? Do you want a king?
Yeah.
You know, why are you saying that we shouldn't have democracy?
Yeah. Well, again, you know,
and of course they don't know what there are different flavors of democracy usually either. It's just something that they're parrot that they've heard on Fox or somewhere, I suppose.
Sure, sure.
But people need to ask them about things like this. Mm. I think that's where a lot of conservatives and right-wingers get a pass.
Yeah.
They just blow something out and then nobody follows up.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, this is from Black Lives Matter. On Monday, representatives from a community in active struggle against state-sanctioned killing, violence, and repression met with the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama. Not civil rights leaders, not activists, not spokespeople. This wasn't a group of Beltway African-Americans. This wasn't a delegation of respectable African-Americans. This was an assemblage of yes, or what? Nor was it an assemblage of yes men and women. We were from Missouri, Ohio, New York, and Florida, and it all happened quickly, and yes, we all were skeptical. We all knew that White House stood to benefit more from this meeting than we did. We knew that our movement families would fear the almighty co-opt in a political press photo op, and we have been underestimated at every junction, sometimes from all sides, but this was an invitation that you accept, period. The invitation was extended with a clear goal. The president wanted to hear about what was going on around the country, and we answered that call with clarity and brutal honesty. The door opened, we sat down, exchanged cordialities, and went to work. We told President Obama that we were not the people's spokespeople. We told him that we had neither the power, positions, nor desires to stop the eruptions in the streets, and that they would continue until a radical change happened in this country. We told him that we had no faith in anything, church or state. We told him that the country was on the brink and that nothing short of a major capitulation at all levels of the government to the demands of the people could prevent it. Straight talk like that. We asked for the president to utilize his pulpit to spark the governmental cultural shift that this movement calls for. We told him to end the Department of Defense's 1033 program, to end federal funding to police departments with histories of discrimination, harassment, and murder. And we beseeched President Obama to invest in community-based alternatives to policing and incarceration and challenged him on the lack of data on the state's systemic and underreported killings of unarmed black and Latino people. He cautioned us against demanding too big and stress gradualism. He counseled us that the wheels of progress turn sluggishly, reminded us of the progress that got us to this point, a room full of black folk in the Oval Office. He asked for our help, hearkening back to his organizing days in the streets of Chicago, the cries of the people shifted the landscape. We debated on the power of the vote and the lack of faith in the Democratic Party. We walked out of that meeting unbought and unbowed. We held no punches. There was no code switching or boot licking, no concessions, politicking or prosecuting. The movement got this meeting. Unrest earned this invite, and we can't stop. If we don't get what we came for, we will shut it down. President Obama knows that, and we know it. No meeting can stop that. I saw this morning on the internet, and I was both surprised and pretty impressed by this, actually. And, you know, I just had to share that with the listeners today.
We were talking about local action and things,
you
know, and we mentioned that minimum wage is going up in 21 states. Many cities have kind of taken it on their own to actually raise minimum wage much more. San Francisco, mm-hmm. Chicago pushing, Seattle pushing for $15 an hour minimum wage. A Kentucky county just voted to approve the first local right-to-work ordinance.
Oh.
This is something that's being pushed by ALEC, the mm-hmm. American Legislative Exchange Council. And they're passing this in a county in Kentucky, so that includes Bowling Green. And what they're doing is promoting the idea of passing right-to-work ordinances on city and county levels, recognizing the success and progressive in pursuing labor rights on the local level. These anti-union groups have decided to try their own version of small-scale warfare. So they're pushing to do this in states like Washington, Montana, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting that now they're moving to try and pass these right-to-work issues on county levels, mm-hmm, and things like that. So,
yeah.
Is that legal?
It's been questioned about whether how effective it'll be, but I'm sure they've had a team of lawyers looking into this.
This will go into court, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
I tell you, what I see from conservative people, mm-hmm, all right, they probably don't even care.
Yeah.
They'll go ahead and they'll push it and then they'll get knocked down.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, like Ted Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ted Cruz, he's got a law degree from Harvard.
Yeah.
Is that right, or is it Yale? One of those two. And the guy, he spouts unconstitutional crap right and left.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama, constitutional law professor.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill, you know, there's two sets of laws, one for us and one for the ruling class. Glenn Greenwald just wrote a book about that. I can't remember the title. Liberty and Justice for Some, that's the name of it.
Says here, promoters of the effort argue that although federal labor law generally preempts any local ordinances, Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act, mm-hmm, which permits right-to-work laws in any state or territory, is ambiguous as to whether it applies to cities or counties.
It says state or territory. It doesn't say city or county, does it?
I can see the wiggle room.
Territory.
Yeah, I can see the wiggle room there. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on List Works Community Radio Station, WFT, in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back after this music break.
Program. A religious fanatic posts footage of an interfaith service project. A group of teenage boys watches a video of a father playing catch with his son. An adult film star paints thumbnail portraits of elderly couples fully clothed and smiling. A record executive records a demo of his apology. A policeman makes reverse 911 calls, instructing residents to take to the streets. A patriarch reports for duty. She's wearing an orange jumpsuit.
Okay, that was the Flobots, and that was a song, let's see here, it was called Anne Braden. We now have our special guest in the studio, James Kilgore. James, welcome back to World Labor.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Okay.
Bob, Bill. Nice
okay.
to be here.
All right. And I know you've been on a couple times in the past with Ken Salo talking about South Africa, but we invited you back to talk about some things that have been happening locally, in particular, in your part of the local here, I guess.
So, and employment issues.
And employment issues, indeed. So I guess I'll have you just let's start with some of the controversy and employment problems you've been having in the last year.
Okay, well, it's a little bit long and complicated, but I'll try to summarize it as best I can. But, I mean, I worked at the University of Illinois from 2011 until early this year. I was employed as an academic hourly in the Center for African Studies, and I also did some teaching on a contract basis, what they call adjunct,
mm-hmm,
precarious labor is what
yes,
it is.
Yes.
And so in February of this year, the News Gazette ran a 4-page spread in the Sunday paper about my background, my so-called criminal background, etc. And basically they were calling for my employment to be severed at the university.
And that was back in the spring, wasn't it? And it just so happened to be kind of in the middle of a primary election?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. So it was February, right, when the debate was heating up, and there was some effort to try to connect me
yes.
to Carol Ammons and so forth.
Yes.
I think
because you're both part of the same organization here in town, Champaign-Urbana
right.
Citizens for Peace and Justice. Okay.
Right, right. So, basically, I mean, what the News Gazette had put in the paper isn't anything that I hadn't fully disclosed to the university when I was employed. Mm-hmm. I knew, I mean, I didn't hide my background. I didn't hide my criminal convictions. I didn't hide the fact that I spent 6.5 years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that this kind of thing could happen. And I certainly didn't want anyone who employed me at the university to be surprised by this and feel as if I had somehow, you know, betrayed the trust, their trust. And mm-hmm. I even insisted when I was employed that the heads of department, you know, get approval from the dean and so forth to hire me in because of my background to make sure that everybody would be covered in that case.
Yeah, so you made some real efforts to sort of make sure that wasn't going to happen, you know.
And despite all the hysteria in the article about the things that I did in the 1970s, there was never any accusation that I had hidden any of this
mm-hmm.
or in any way tried to deceive the university about what my employment, about what my past was.
Mm-hmm.
So then the university kept quiet on this until there was an article in the Chicago Tribune in March.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few days later, the deans got an order to stop any future employment contracts for me.
Okay.
And it wasn't clear where this came from, but it started to become clearer that it came from the Board of Trustees because they were really the only ones that could issue such an order.
Okay.
And so at that point, a group of faculty, you know, began to organize around this issue because there was a question of the department head should have final authority over employment for temporary workers. And that's always been the case, and there's never been really interference from a board of trustee level, certainly for somebody who's employed at an academic hourly, which is really at the kind of bottom of the pecking order in academia.
And how long had you been teaching as an adjunct at the U of I prior to this?
I taught for a little over a year
in
different departments.
And, okay. Yeah. Okay.
And I had already, you know, been recommended for employment for all of this academic year in teaching 5 different classes.
Okay.
In the program of global studies and also in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning.
And all your supervisors liked your work performance. The students, I understand, thought you were a great instructor, so.
Absolutely. There was no complaint at all from any of those, quarters. And
mm-hmm.
in fact, you know, they had already put in requests to reemploy me for the coming year. I had been on the excellent teachers list for the 2 courses that I had taught for global studies.
Mm-hmm.
So we then began sort of a campaign around this, put up a petition on change.org, the group called the Friends of James Kilgore, which is basically a core of faculty members who were sympathetic to the situation and didn't like the interference from outside.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately 310 of these faculty signed a petition demanding my reemployment, and that was presented to the provost and the chancellor in early May. 4 days later, Chris Kennedy, the chairman of the Board of Trustees, made a public statement to the News Gazette saying that I shouldn't be employed under any circumstances because I'm a domestic terrorist and domestic terrorists should not be employed by the university. So he was kind of stepping in and you know, intervening without really any formal authority, but it became quite clear that that's where the intervention had come from, although in a private meeting that I had had with the provost, along with my wife, who's also a faculty member, when we had asked him where the order to stop my employment had come from, he said, I can't say.
Uh-huh.
And what process had it gone through, he said, I can't say.
Oh.
So there was no transparency there,
mm-hmm.
but there's only a few places it could have come from. And so when Chris Kennedy came out with that, it became clear there was a Board of Trustees issue. So it kind of sat there. And then in May, the provost appointed a committee to look into my employment and to look into the circumstances under which I was employed to see if there were any irregularities and also to make some recommendations about assessing criminal background in the future around issues of employment.
Mm-hmm.
So that committee met through the course of the summer. And, of course, they couldn't really find any irregularity in my employment process because the university had no policy on how to factor in criminal backgrounds in the employment process. So there was nothing to say whether the policy had been violated or not. But they did interview all the people that had hired me, and each one of them said that I had fully revealed my background, that I had done a good job, that they wanted to reemploy me and so forth. So this committee, which was largely made up of people from, you know, sciences and engineering who really didn't have much familiarity with the areas of work where I was involved, you know, recommended that I should be rehired. They said that, you know, that I had been a valuable employee and that they recommended I should have been rehired with immediate effect.
Mm-hmm.
So of course now in the middle of all this, there was another big hiring conflict at the university, which was the whole question of Stephen Salaita, which kind of, you know, intersected with mine and
yes.
had some similarities, but also some important differences.
Mm-hmm.
So in the meantime, most of the focus went on Stephen Salaita. Although the committee had recommended in August that I be rehired, the provost had told me that the issue would not be decided until it was taken before the Board of Trustees. So on September 11th, my issue was supposed to be brought up at the same time as Stephen Salaita's.
Mm-hmm.
But it got dropped from the agenda while they focused on Stephen Salaita. What they told me was because the faculty had planned a demonstration at noon, they cut the Board of Trustees meeting short, and so they didn't have time to look at my issue. Well, the next meeting wasn't until November, which basically means it's the end of term,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't be employed. But in the November 14th meeting, the Board of Trustees, in closed session, basically agreed that the university administration was free to decide how they wanted to decide in terms of my employment. And the university has said that they're going to allow people to reemploy me. So I now have an agreement signed that I'll teach a course next term in global studies. And there's some process for my rehiring in the Center for African Studies.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's kind of a long and complicated process. I mean, I'd like to just say, I think there's really four big issues that are involved in this. And I think, The first one is, which is the one that came out in the Salaita case as well, is the question of university governance and
mm-hmm.
what powers the Board of Trustees should have and what powers the administration should have at the campus level and what powers department heads should have in terms of hiring, employment, and so forth. And I mean, I think there's a big push from faculty to say that those hiring decisions must rest with faculty and with department. That's where they are supposed to be in the processes and procedures of the university. That's where the expertise is supposed to be, and that's and any interference in that amounts to undermining of some sort of transparency and delegation of responsibility
sure,
within the
yeah.
university. The second issue, which I think is an important one, and which was also important in the Salaita issue, is the question of academic freedom. I mean, on what basis was I not going to be allowed to teach? On the basis of something that I did 30 or 40 years ago? There was no complaints about my job performance. So what, is there a fear that I was going to say something that the students might not like or that might make them do something that somebody else might like? What is it that was actually going on here? And is there nothing, is there no appreciation of the fact that when people have gone through a long and complicated experiences, particularly including, you know, criminal prosecution and incarceration, is there nothing that those particular people have to teach from that experience to students? And are they not some of perhaps the best people to steer people away from, you know, that kind of path?
Mm-hmm.
So, excuse me, the third issue is the issue of the hiring of adjunct and contingent faculty, precarious academic labor, which is growing in leaps and bounds in academia.
Mm-hmm.
And people are hired and fired on very short notice, have, you know, very short-term contracts, low pay, poor benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a part of a broader corporatization of the university, looking for cheaper labor and cutting costs rather than looking at going to benefit the academic project. And then the last issue, which I don't think is the least important, is the question of where does criminal background figure in to the into the hiring process in the university. Now, unfortunately, nationally, there's a trend to open the doors and to minimize, you know, the requirements because we have 70 million people now in this country that have a criminal background, about 15, 16 million people with felony convictions. And there's absurd blockages for people. I mean, in some places you can't become a barber, can't become a hairdresser if you have a felony conviction. There's a whole range of prohibitions on employment for people with criminal backgrounds. And one of the most absurd things that's happened is that the Big Ten schools have all, most of them have now put criminal background checks into academic employment, and the excuse they're giving is the Jerry Sandusky case, which is absolutely absurd, because how is no criminal background check was going to stop Jerry Sandusky, because he didn't have a criminal background. And so it's, but they're using this as an excuse now to try to keep people from seeping in through the cracks and putting more obstacles in the way of people with criminal backgrounds, whereas the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission and other national bodies are pushing for a relaxation of those things, seeing that we have so many people with criminal backgrounds now in this country that it's actually affecting, you know, the labor market, and it's affecting, you know, a marginalized sector of the working class, which is finding it harder and harder to get employment.
Indeed. Okay, Bill, you want to say something?
Yeah, kind of little partying scrapes that I would get into back when I was young. I'm really, that's one of the reasons I stay as a laborer, because nothing like that comes up. And
well, yeah, we've joked before. Don't you need a felony conviction to be a member of the laborers union?
No.
Okay.
Just being official.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, but I think that's important.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a, in some unions you can't hold a union office if you have a felony conviction. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Right. Well, that, and it also used to be too, if you had been a member of the Communist Party.
Yes.
Right.
And who was it that got that struck down in the 60s?
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a music break. Maybe you can Google it, if nothing else. And you're listening to World Labor Hour on WFT Community Radio Station, Champaign, Illinois. And anyway, we're going to be back with James Kilgore to talk about a couple other topics. So stay tuned.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the story you're about to hear is true and long overdue. The names have not been changed to expose
Once
the guilty.
Upon a time in
Bankersville, USA, land of swap opportunity. They caused the housing crisis in the community. Selling bad loans like bundles of dope. They called it suicide mortgage. Ought to come with a rope. In Hudson City, there was 5 foreclosure gangs. The most ruthless one was Brian Moynihan's home after 8 years in Washington Federal. Looking for his old flame, Cafe General. But word on the street, she been sleeping with the enemy. Had a daughter with Jamie Dimon and named the Equity. James Gorman put the fair in Savoir. Drove an almond, colored almond, flag star Jaguar. Latin assassin by the name of West Bronco. Hostage negotiators, Bank West condo. He had a bulletproof reputation, Teflon, mandatory mediation. Morgan Stanley hated Goldman Sachs. Why? Some fakers about robo signed contracts. Chase had them ghetto loans countrywide. Raw deals looking sweeter than a pumpkin pie. His eye candy gold digger named Aurora was a stripper at Santander Club in Florida. She had this pair of New York melons, hypnotizing with the cleavers. They bought everything she's selling. Jailhouse lawyers and juries holding street court. Bailouts, Pacific Capital, the Key Corp. They smuggled mortgages underwater, infested with sharks, while Franklin Bank drove a golf cart with an iPhone.
Okay, that was Twice Thou, and the name of that song was Bankerville, USA. And I couldn't help playing that, considering one of the news stories we had today about another bailout coming down the tubes for the big banks at our expense. But anyway, some quick public service announcements. Another sports show with host fellow worker Neil Parthen today and every Saturday from 2 to 3 p.m. on 104.5 FM WRFU, and Wednesdays at 6 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. It's a really good show if you have never checked it out. It's basically talks about it's not just another sports show. It's a basically, Neil talks about sports and its political and social context, and it's a very interesting show. Okay, and also on Urbana Public Television this Sunday and every Sunday on Comcast Channel 6 and UrbanaPublicTelevision.org is 9/11 TV from 3 to 4 p.m., followed by Labor's Worldview from 4 to 5. And James, is there any events coming up here in the next week that you might want to let the listeners know about off the top of your head? Okay, because I was looking for something. See, of course, it's the holidays.
It's
so
a holiday.
It's,
I think
yeah,
we're
pretty
kind
quiet
of taking
here.
It easy, but there's been a lot of mobilization going on around issues of police militarization in response to what's happened in Ferguson and with Eric Garner in New York. So
indeed.
I think some of that's going to continue in the new year for sure.
And Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice, are they having a meeting today at 4 p.m.?
Oh, no, we're taking the day off today.
Okay, all right.
But normally we meet on Saturday at 4 p.m. at the IMC, 202 North Broadway. Yeah.
Okay.
WEFT is wanting to mention people that, you know, we had some transmitter issues and stuff.
Oh, yes.
So we've got this Power to the Tower fund drive that we're kind of running right now. So if you have year-end tax-deductible contributions, you can mail that to 113 North Market Street. Stop by the station anytime next week and drop that off. You know, it took quite a bit of expense to get us back on the air, and we still have some ongoing issues out there that we're still addressing, and we're going to need to spend a few more dollars out there. And so, yeah, anything extra that you have at the end of the year here, we could certainly appreciate it.
Okay, very good. Yeah. All right, thanks, Bob. Well, James, that last point you made about your success of getting rehired, the U of I had to do with people getting organized and putting pressure on the powers that be. I just couldn't help but think about what's been going on, not just nationally, but here locally in Champaign, Urbana. So I guess I'm just going to open it up on that note.
Well, I think, certainly over the course of the last couple of years, we've been organizing quite a bit around different issues related to, the criminal justice system. We've had a long, an ongoing campaign against the construction of the jail. There's been a lot of movement around trying to oppose the imposition of tasers. But I think more recently, in response to the failure to indict around the killing of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, there's been a lot of things going on to try to mobilize people locally, and one of the targets has been this this militarized vehicle that the sheriff has acquired through the federal government, this 1033 program, which has given out these militarized vehicles. Basically they're tanks with this federal program 1033. Over 400 municipalities have gotten these things, municipalities, counties, and so forth. You just pay the transportation costs and do a little paint touch up, and you've got yourself a tank to roll down the streets. And so when this happened, this was exposed through Brian Dolliner's writing in the public eye, and then later he wrote a piece that circulated nationally in Truth Out to say that these are a threat in local communities, that we don't need this kind of policing, that these kinds of vehicles came out on the streets when there was demonstrations in Ferguson, and that we don't want that kind of policing going on in our communities when people demonstrate or when there's ordinary kinds of criminal prosecutions or arrests. We don't want a major military mobilization to take one or two people out of the house who have a stash of drugs or something like that. So there's been, we've mobilized a lot of people to go to the county board, put a resolution there. We've also formed a coalition of about 18 local organizations to stand up against police militarization, and we're going to keep going with this. And some of that focus has also gone into trying to stop the Urbana police from acquiring tasers, another form of kind of the militarization of police. These things are, these things are dangerous. They can sometimes kill people, particularly people who have health issues and so forth. And so we just don't think this is in line with the sort of community policing that we would like to see, the kinds of accountability that we want to see from police officers. And all of these tend to be very racialized in terms of where do they get used, whether it's a military vehicle, whether it's a taser. They tend to be used in places like Champaign-Urbana, disproportionately in the African-American community, which also has more than 50% of the people in the jail population, even though representing only about 13% of the county's population.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think tasers are banned actually in Canada. You think about it, a taser is not really a non-lethal device. I mean, I'm kind of going out on a limb here, but to me it seems like it's more of a torture and non-compliance instrument.
Well, and the Urbana police have had, I don't know if it's still this way, a policy of not using tasers. Okay? So what they do is they bring Champaign County Sheriff's deputies with them to calls. And there is a laborer that I work with occasionally, and his son was at his house, and his son was in a fight with his girlfriend. That is the son's girlfriend. And the police were called. I'm not sure, maybe neighbors called or something. And the Urbana police showed up with a Champaign County deputy sheriff. And the kid was all excited or something. And anyway, the deputy tased him. And because they had talked to the father before the tasing, this kid thinks that the father told him to go ahead and tase him, and now he won't talk to his dad.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
But although Urbana has had a ban in the past, I mean, there are now, I mean, there's been ongoing discussions for the last several months at the city council, quite heated discussions about whether or not, you know, we want to see tasers in Urbana. And I think that's yet to be resolved, but it's, there's a lot of opposition to it. I mean, Carol Ammons on the city council has led the opposition. The vendors have been there trying to promote them. There's been a lot of debate about that.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, do they bring out like any numbers, of incidents where they've had to use some type of non-lethal force to subdue somebody?
What are these taser hawkers, what are they trying to say?
Well, I mean, basically what their argument is that a taser is an alternative to a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And so that if people have tasers, police have tasers, the result is people are going to be tased and not shot.
I mean, really?
What other people are saying is that actually tasers are an alternative to less means of force, such as, God forbid, talking to people, trying to calm people down, trying to resolve things through nonviolent means, or even a club, which is a lot less of likely to inflict mortal injury than tasers.
Yeah, there's so many of these instances where it's basically the police are baiting people. Mm-hmm. And I had that happen in Normal when I'd be in college with the Normal police up there at Illinois State.
Mm-hmm.
They hated students and they would pull up. One time I was cut off by a police car, similar to what happened with Michael Brown, and this cop started telling me that I was really drunk at the time.
Yeah.
But I ended up, he illegally arrested me because I wasn't resisting arrest before I got arrested.
Okay.
You know? But I think in the local situation, I mean, recently we've had some fairly significant mobilizations. We had a mobilization of about 250 people at the courthouse.
Yes.
Around the Ferguson and the Eric Garner piece. The Centennial High School students did a walkout, which ended up some of the students went into the street. A woman tried to drive a car through there, and there was a conflict. One of the students hit her window, and then they wanted to prosecute the student.
And not the driver.
So, yeah. So there was
a
whole.
Did the window actually break?
Cracked, I think.
Cracked the window. So there was a whole mobilization to the school board to press them not to charge the students. Then there's been mobilization at Central High School. There's been mobilization across town. And so there's been the GEO organized a massive sort of die-in on campus, which had several hundred people participating over the course of 4.5 hours. And so that we're getting a new level of kind of mobilization and activism, which it creates even more basis of a fear of harsher intervention, by the police.
Mm-hmm. I've talked to some friends of mine that live in larger cities around the country, like Oakland, New York City, and they're just amazed that all the things you just described that I told them, that's happened here just in the last month or so, and because they only hear about what's happening in the larger cities around the country, other than, say, Ferguson,
Well, similarly, Dave, you remember when the Staley situation?
Yes.
Back in the 90s.
The impetus for this program, actually.
Yeah, and I always thought when that was going on, you'd be in Decatur, and there would be thousands of people in these gigantic, huge rallies. You had Vietnam War veterans and camouflage with the Road Warriors and all of that. I mean, to me, it looked like a fantastic human interest story.
Yeah.
And it never got on the networks.
Of course not.
And I know from working at TV stations, it was widely available to all the networks because it was being covered by the local stations.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably uploading it.
This is interesting, this trend with police militarization. Do you have any idea kind of when and where this started? Was it after the invasion of Iraq or Afghanistan? Does it go back farther than that? Or is it more recent?
I think in the recent era, police militarization really comes hand in hand with the war on drugs. It's during the early 1980s where Reagan in particular started making available to police large-scale grants to up their technology to increase their weaponry and so forth. And this was also the time where we saw the implementation of a rapid increase of the creation of SWAT squads and all these kinds of special drug enforcement squads that use, that are trained in these military techniques and that you, that, that use this technology. So I think that's really the foundation of this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now that we have a whole nother generation of war veterans coming home, we have people who are working in some of these, police forces and in the prisons who are trained in using this equipment. So it's kind of familiar to them as well, which further, you know, makes it kind of a nice fit from the standpoint of the police in terms of having people being able to use this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just wondering too, hasn't it been pretty much almost a prerequisite for, I would say at least since the 70s for, police to have been ex-military? Or is there a great advantage for ex-military to be hired by police?
Yeah, I don't think it's a prerequisite, but obviously
that's why I said almost prerequisite. Yeah. It seems like all the cops I ever run into were ex-military. Yeah.
But just because somebody's in the military doesn't mean that they were in combat situations, like as an occupying soldier,
Baghdad. It is kind of the definition of militarization.
It reveals to me is that these instances have been happening. This is not just a couple bad cops that might have not passed the psychological screenings for being psychopath. This seems to me that this is part of their training now.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But here's another one. A lot of those people at Abu Ghraib,
mm-hmm.
they were, and this is kind of the opposite of what I was saying, they were prison guards in civilian life. And then they carried on whatever their feelings were. I guess they got there and it's like, wow, we can do whatever we always wanted to do.
But I don't think I think we're flipping it a little bit.
Okay.
I don't think the question is actually the military, in the presence of former military and the police.
Right.
The question is that the criminal justice system has changed its orientation from one that focused on some kind of a process of rehabilitation, so where probation officers, parole officers were trained in some kind of social work and were supposed to create some kind of a supportive environment, and where prisons and jails had programs that educated and trained people so when they got out they would have some kind of a way forward. Now, from my own experience of incarceration, that's not what goes on in prisons and jails these days, nor is it what happens in the criminal justice system. People are trained in punishment and incapacitation. That's what goes on in these institutions. So you're right in the sense that it's part of the training, but it's not just the presence of military, but it's a shift from a more liberal social welfareist approach to criminal justice to a really hardcore law and order approach, which really came in with Reagan and has been sustained throughout, Democrat or Republican,
yes.
And has sustained this enormous expansion in the construction of prisons and jails, and has transformed the way in which policing and so-called corrections are carried out in these institutions.
Okay. Yep. Is it just more awareness of these shootings by police of unarmed, mainly minority young men, or has there actually been an increase in the last couple of years for some reason?
I think it's more awareness than actual numbers.
Okay.
This has been going on for quite some time. But what we have seen in the last, say, 4 or 5 years is we've begun to see some resistance, to mass incarceration. We've had a whole education process about what Michelle Alexander refers to as the new Jim Crow, and this has had some popular resonance. So we've begun to see people in African-American communities in particular beginning to fight back against this. We've seen formerly incarcerated people begin to organize around issues of mass incarceration. And I think also we've seen massive resistance amongst immigrants against deportation and against immigration detention, mm-hmm. and also targeting the private prison corporations. So I think all of these things have brought the way in which law and order is being carried out into the fore. And so now when these killings take place, there's just a lot quicker response to them because people's awareness is much heightened. I mean, 10 years ago, if you said mass incarceration, it didn't mean anything to people. example. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But now it's widely known amongst large sectors of the population that the United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, that is disproportionately people of color who are getting locked up, and that state budgets are being bled dry by the expenditure on prisons and jails, to the point where even right-wingers like Newt Gingrich are coming out and saying they want to cut back on prison building.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to say that unions are playing a role in this. Something I wanted to ask you when you were talking about the local stuff was you're talking about this, like, dealing with the city governments. Do you ever get any feedback, like, from the unions on these things, like the police unions, on whether they want to use tasers or not, or they just not?
There was a really recent state public statement from the chief of police of Urbana, wasn't there, James?
Right.
Yeah, basically criticizing a lot of the people that turned up at the taser meeting. Because they were discriminating against veterans, supposedly, when they brought up the issue of militarization of the police. Huh. More or less.
Well, no, what I was thinking is, like, for example, the California prisoners unions are notorious for lobbying for more laws to put more people in prison and to build more prisons. And I would assume that there is something, activity like that in every state by those unions.
Well, in Illinois, the union that organizes prison guards primarily is AFSCME.
Mm-hmm.
And, AFSCME has been pretty much pro-incarceration, but I think there is now beginning to be some agitation within AFSCME, to question some of that. SEIU, on the other hand, has begun to take a much stronger positions on mass incarceration, particularly the racialized aspects of mass incarceration, and they organize some people in the corrections departments who work, like, in the offices and mm-hmm. so forth.
I saw what was bad was that police union leader in New York City recently blaming the mayor and
the
protesters for that crazy person
killing the two cops. Yeah. I mean, that's outrageous. You know, I mean, it's not even worth discussing. You know, even though I have no problems doing that, but we're kind of running out of time here.
Yeah.
But you know, also there's the economic class factor too involved in this. I mean, it's inescapable to see. I mean, first of all these police killings are happening in poor working class neighborhoods, but it's obvious that African Americans are taking the brunt of it. You know, I mean, I've gotten into some arguments here in the last couple of weeks, debates, if you will, with some European-American coworkers of mine who look at this as a racial issue and think that the cops are justified because of high crime. And my response is, well, look what happened in Albuquerque. Last summer?
Oh, that guy with the knife out in the desert that was camping?
Yeah.
They went to give him a $10 fine?
Yes. And the SWAT team raided his camp. He's camped in National Forest outside the city.
I've seen that video.
So, I mean, he was legally camping. And, brought in the whole SWAT team and killed the guy. I mean, there's and you look at various points, other places in this country. I mean, like, besides the inner cities, there's like the some of the Indian reservations out west, in particular the
Native Americans have the highest rate of death by police.
Followed by
blacks,
mm-hmm.
and then Hispanics, then whites, then Asians.
Yeah, and then you have West Virginia, which has been reduced. The whole state almost has been reduced to a third world country, and I mean, crime is rampant there. So are police killings and drug trade and everything else. I mean, Chris Hedges recently wrote a book about this. He called them sacrifice zones, and Detroit is definitely one of these. So I guess, you know, this plays.
Well, the coal companies always kept West Virginia in the third world.
I think it's important to recognize that this whole process of mass incarceration is also connected to deindustrialization.
Right. Yes.
And so we've got these inner cities that have lost in industrial jobs in places like Chicago, which did provide some, union jobs for people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And those have largely fled. And we've also seen similar things happen in small towns and rural towns, which are predominantly white. So
mm-hmm.
we've seen this deindustrialization affecting both poor whites and inner city African Americans mm-hmm. and Latinos. But one of the things that's happened is that some of the solution to that in some of these poor rural areas has been to build prisons, and then whites get jobs in the prisons so that it enhances
to guard the people they went to school with.
It enhances the racial tension between, rural poor whites and poor urban African Americans,
mm-hmm.
and instead of having some kind of commonality and enabling them to work together to deal with these issues. So I think these economic issues that you're raising are really important. And I always like to frame mass incarceration as a working class issue.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it's not an issue of criminality, and it's not even just an issue of law and order or solely about race, but it's about a marginalized sector of the working class, which is disproportionately African American, disproportionately Latino, and that's who's getting impacted by mass incarceration. Both the men who are ending up in prison and the women who are left in these communities, which have been deindustrialized and also had a lot of their welfare system stripped away, so they're barely able to survive in these kind of bare bones communities that remain behind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of these people are right down the road from my house in a jail that Dave helped build in Monticello, Illinois, in the wilds of Piatt County.
Yeah.
There are many sightings of Cook County jail buses.
Well, that's the thing.
You bring these people hundreds of miles away when they're supposed to be in county jail, not prison.
That was the thing. I remember the first day I got to that.
They purposely overbuilt it for that.
Well, I was going to say, the first day I got to that job and saw the size of the job site and looked at the blueprints, it's like, holy crap, this is a small prison. This isn't some county jail for Monticello, you know, or Piatt County. And, yeah, they told me then that this was going to be used to house overflow prisoners from Champaign County, Macon County, McLean County, and even probably eventually.
Oh, there's Cook County buses there, at least on a weekly basis
now.
Mm-hmm.
But one other thing I was going to mention is that, you know, it's kind of interesting when I had these debates with some of my European American white coworkers was that, you know, what I'm saying is look, don't think this can't happen to you or somebody you know. Because it's just a matter of time before this is going to come to your community and your neighborhood if things get bad enough here economically. Made them stop to think a little bit, you know, when I phrased it that way, you know. And we got to understand something, you know, the ruling class in this country and their corporate media are masters at being able to pit people against each other. Divide and conquer. It's what they've been doing ever since the time of the plantations, you know, when you had the early uprisings, on the plantations that were comprised of both the revolters were comprised of both the African slaves and European, mainly Irish indentured servants. And that's shortly after that they instituted the segregation laws to divide. And so you got to look at it that way. And that's one thing I always stress. But, you know, what's interesting, too, is that this increased militarization, it's almost like the ruling class in this country, especially after the Occupy movement of only a couple years ago, are a little bit concerned. Because it seems like they're pushing full speed ahead on their, you know, their agenda, both economically and politically, to try to grab more power, more wealth at our expense. And, it seems like, they know, or they fear what might be coming, you know, as they continue with their insatiable lust for greed and power. So I think all these things factor in, and I think this is going to be definitely something that's not going to go away anytime soon. James, your opinion on that?
Well, I think, yeah.
Throw it out there.
Yeah, I think we are at a point where we could see, you know, the blossoming of some larger social movements, unlike what we haven't seen in recent times. I mean, I think we don't know yet what's going to happen.
Right.
I mean, we had Occupy, but Occupy turned out to be more of a flash than a steady heat. We'll have to see what happens from the social movements that have come on the ground. I mean, one thing that I think is different about the social movements that we've seen is that there has been a lot of participation, you know, by inner city African Americans, which wasn't there in Occupy, and whether this can create a different kind of social movement, one that can sustain the struggles and take up a range of issues, I think will remain to see whether the leaders that went to speak to Obama, Philip Agnew and company,
yes,
whether they can build an organization that has some staying power to keep the issues on the ground. I mean, one of the things is it's easy to get people mobilized when there's a specific thing to respond to.
Yes.
But what's much harder is to sustain an organization that can keep building and educating its members and be able to respond at a higher level the next time there's some kind of crisis that occurs. And that's what we haven't had, you know, in recent times. I think the immigrants' rights movement has given us a window on some ways in which we might be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if it can.
Okay.
Dave, I have a public service announcement.
Yes, sir.
Visiting hours for non-local inmates at the Piatt County Jail are Wednesdays 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. and Sundays 4 p.m. to 6 p.m.
Wow. That's kind of, that'd be a little inconvenient for somebody,
yeah,
who has
Cook County.
A relative or friend, you know, in Cook County. But, James, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time because I definitely want to talk about your years in South Africa, which I guess we're going to have to use an excuse to get you back on the show sometime in the future. Because I think there's some parallels there too, is there not?
No, absolutely. I think there's a lot to discuss about, you know, the building of social movements and how, you know, how they function. And I think there's some lessons to be learned from South Africa, both positive and
negative. Yeah. Okay. Well, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supported Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Until next week, stay tuned for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter. In the meantime, be safe and power to the people. Take care.